Energy Transition, episode number 86. Our topic today is big oil mergers and acquisitions. Hello, everyone. Hello, Irina. Irina. Yeah, Irina, that's a good point to talk a little bit because Irina left our group. She has different challenges, professional challenges. So
we wish her the best of luck. She's going to be missed for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
She is fantastic. Yes. Please let me start showing some pictures. One, the first one is Chevron bought Hess for $53 billion. And ExxonMobil bought Pioneer for around $59 billion. Tammy, could you please contextualize this scenario of a big oil purchasing phase?
Sure. I'm sure David will be able to add a whole bunch of extra information on this. But, you know, it's interesting. The last time there was this big thrust of acquisitions, and David, please correct me if I'm wrong, was in the late 90s, early 2000s, when you got the big ExxonMobil merger and some other ones. And I wonder, because one of the articles discussed how these were increasing the asset bases. And I wonder if these mergers are because of the permitting issues for future exploration and production, they might not be forthcoming. And therefore, the big companies want to consolidate what is existing to ensure that they have enough assets there to fill their pipelines and refineries and whatnot, and have control over it. So also with the offshore, again, is it because in the United States and in Canada and elsewhere in the West, it's very difficult to do proper exploration and development anymore. The process takes forever and there's opposition and the governments are, you know, resisting it. So, or preventing it. And so we have this move for the acquisitions in order to, I believe, increase their asset base. David, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is the biggest set of mergers since the late 90s, for sure. There's no doubt about that. It's very comparable to the BP, Amoco, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco combinations that took place at that time, reduced the number of seven sisters from Standard Oil down to five, I think, and that's been further reduced since then. You know, it is interesting. I do think the motivator is mainly to fill their, as you said, their internal pipelines for new drilling and development opportunities domestically in the United States, as permitting does become increasingly difficult. And you know, if the Biden administration is reelected next year, it will become much more difficult for an additional 4 years. And so, you know, they're always looking out, planning for the future. The Exxon and Pioneer merger has been expected for quite some time. And my gosh, I first started writing about rumors surrounding that specific combination in 2018. I went back and took a look. So 5 years later, it finally got done. And that was not unexpected at all. It is part of the general consolidation that has been ongoing in the shale sector in the United States for several years now. That's going to continue. We see rumors now of ConocoPhillips pursuing another acquisition, pretty sizable one. And then the Chevron deal with Hess is really interesting from a different standpoint, and that is, of course, acquiring that huge position in the biggest Western Hemisphere offshore development in recent years in Guyana that ExxonMobil is the operator of. And it expands Hess's position in that region, which includes Brazil, of course, Armando, they've had significant operations there. Suriname, which is a neighboring country to Guyana. And it just it creates this interesting dynamic now where the two biggest U.S. majors are partners in that Stabroek Block offshore Guyana development that's going to continue for many years to come. There's already, as of July, they're producing 410,000 barrels per day out of Stabroek and expect to be producing over 1 million barrels a day by 2027. And, you know, it will continue to grow after that pretty significantly if ExxonMobil's plans for that remain in place. It's also interesting to point out, I think, ExxonMobil has 45% of that Stabroek development. Chevron has will now own 30%. And the third partner in that consortium is CNOOC, the Chinese national oil company, with 25%. So you have the two biggest American majors partnering with the Chinese national oil company in that major development there, which is a really interesting partnership and has worked pretty well, you know, with Hess involved so far, and no reason to expect anything really to change. But it does really boost Chevron's international assets, as well as the big position in the Bakken Shale that they acquired from Hess as well. And Chevron, you know, I think we'll have to keep pretty much all of those Hess folks in the Bakken in place, because Chevron has no position there at the moment. So pretty good news, I think, for those employees too.
In South America, you mentioned Venezuela and PDVSA. Brazil and Venezuela, the past, they studied, they talk about make a kind of partnership or approximation between PDVSA and Petrobras. So yeah. Thanks God that this not happen. Let me show you something, David, please, about Rystad. Rystad said that it could be the start of mega deals after Pioneer and Hess. So at this size of operation, $60 billion, is medium-sized companies. First medium size, and after maybe big oil companies, really?
Well, I wonder if Tammy's hearing anything about this. There's been a rumor for decades, really decades, that Shell would like to buy BP, merge with BP to combine those two companies. And, you know, BP has had a lot of struggles over the last decade. You wonder if maybe that big deal might ultimately come about. I don't know. Are any rumors flying around in the UK right now, Tammy?
I haven't heard any rumors along those lines. I do know that they're engaging in significant cooperation for a carbon capture project where BP and Shell are working together with a few other companies in order to pursue this massive carbon capture offshore, where they'll take it from industry and then pump it into the North Sea and offshore the UK. And they're utilizing Shell technology that was perfected in Saskatchewan, actually. Yeah. So it's interesting that there is that sense of massive cooperation. And given, yeah, it's hard to say. I haven't heard those rumors, but it wouldn't surprise me. But then again, I don't know. The European situation is fluid, I guess, is one way to say it, you know. Because, you know, Irina had a really good article a few days ago where she was talking about how the European majors had made a significant investment into renewable energies, you know, wind and solar and various other things. But it was like the American majors looked at that and they dabbled a little bit, and then they realized, oh, well, you know, this isn't working. It's expensive and they're not as efficient as advertised. And so there's this shift now to go back to core business. And what's interesting in the Canadian context is that Suncor, which is an oil sands company, had made various investments in renewable energy and was running into significant difficulties. And they have a new CEO. And he said, you know what, we're going to go back to our core business. And he got hauled in front of the House of Commons into some committee to explain his business plan. It's like, why do you care? Like, as if anyone in Parliament even knows how to run a business, and then they want to haul an oil company before to explain himself on why he wants to operate as an oil company. It's just ridiculous. But in any event, one of the interesting purchases that Exxon made was Denbury, and they have the largest CO2 pipeline network in the United States. And so I think they want to capitalize on those incentives for CO2 use and the fact that you can use it for enhanced oil recovery in the United States, whereas in Canada you can't, these different incentives. So that allows Exxon not only to produce more, but to, you know, harvest some of those yeah. subsidies or incentives, as they call them.
Yeah, and so you know, the European countries are under a lot of pressure, right? To yeah. make those investments in renewable energy. There's these crazy court rulings and yeah. the Netherlands and British courts and policies from the central governments in those countries that are kind of forcing them to, but even those companies have, over the course of 2023, notified the markets that they're going to be investing more of their capital going forward in their core businesses. ExxonMobil is focused on carbon capture, really, because ExxonMobil has been doing carbon capture and storage for 40 years in the United States. And as they like to point out, has accounted for 40% of global carbon capture and storage in history at ExxonMobil. So, you know, they have the people on staff who understand that, right? And they don't have to go out and hire a whole new raft of employees to run that business for them. They're already there. Whereas with renewables for ExxonMobil and Chevron, that's a whole new line of business where you would have to go recruit people to manage it. And it just makes a lot more sense for the U.S. majors to go in that other direction. So none of that, I think, is really surprising. But, you know, if ExxonMobil and Chevron were based in London, I think they'd probably be investing in wind and solar, too.
Yeah, let me give a break to show some comments from our audience. Pape Nom,
good morning.
Thanks for sharing. Uh-huh. And he is complimenting with our Noir Africa. João Cândido, a friend of me, came back, please, Irina.
Yes, we miss her too.
Yeah.
Well, maybe she can come back later. That would be great.
Yeah sure. The mergers demonstrate that Exxon and Chevron totally reject, David, the predictions from the international agency, energy agency, or not. Yeah. So they are betting that in 20 or 30 years, they are still producing oil in the same quantity, because this is the signal, no?
Yeah, I mean, 116 million barrels, that's a projection of 16% increase over current demand by 2045, where, yes, the IEA doubled down on its peak oil prediction by 2030 in their annual, what do they call it, the annual global energy report, or anyway, came out last week, and they doubled down on the peak oil prediction, and nobody in the industry believes that, and OPEC certainly doesn't believe that. And again, I think these mergers by Exxon and Chevron, these new huge acquisitions, really indicate that. They indicate that they believe their core businesses are going to be growing, not shrinking, over the coming decades. And there just doesn't seem to be any real reason other than feeding, you know, how these studies are done. They're done with these statistical modeling processes where you feed a bunch of assumptions, you know, in your scenarios into that model, and it spits out a result. Well, the result just depends entirely on the bias of the assumptions that are made. And we've all been involved in those things and know how they work. And IEA is a politically motivated organization that's looking for a specific result. And you can say the same thing about OPEC, I suppose, but OPEC has a profit motive for accurately projecting what the market's going to be, where the IEA has only a political motive, and that's the difference.
And the EIA from the United States is a state. Yes, this is more reliable than others.
Yeah, Tammy, you go ahead and take that.
Yeah, so far. I mean, I feel like, you know, we've had this conversation before with the IEA where they seem to be schizophrenic. So when they talk about their minerals report, that was really well done, where it was realistically assessing what's the future demand of these transition minerals going to be, and how can we move forward to secure it, and how possible or impossible that will be. And then there's the energy outlook with the oil and gas. And it's just, as David says, is so politically motivated now. And it's extremely sad, because the IEA was originally designed to provide a window on the industry to governments in a way that was non-political, so that governments could make the appropriate decisions with respect to policy, and companies could have a better idea of how things were working out globally. But over the past 8 years or so, it's become such a political arm of the OECD and the G7 and the UN to some extent that, you know, their scenarios are just, as David said, just ludicrous. Then you have the Energy Information Administration, which is the American one. And so far, their scenarios and outlooks have been more realistic. But, you know, the issue with the transition is that it is all policy driven. It's all politically driven. It's not about what's best for the economies or best for people in terms of having the heat on and the lights on and mobility that, you know, allows you freedom of movement. It's the opposite of all these things. And so that creates a really big issue with forward-looking predictions, because if your government is committed to this policy thing, this policy trajectory, then yes, I suppose there could be peak oil demand in these developed countries that are embracing these policies. However, reality has a terrible way of kicking these policies in the butt. And one of them, if I can give an example, is what just happened in Canada. So there's a carbon tax in Canada, and it makes everything really expensive, including your heating, because they tax every bit of hydrocarbons. So there is a political base in the eastern part of the country that uses home heating oil. And they were getting ready to say, we're done with the Liberals because they've made it unaffordable to heat our homes coming this winter. And so he announced an exemption of the carbon tax only on home heating oil. So if your furnace runs on natural gas, you still have to pay. And that's the people in Western Canada. But if you use home heating oil, which is his eastern base, well, then you're exempt from paying the carbon tax. So here it is, where he's so committed to this carbon tax, he's trying to bring it in globally, that every country has to do it. And now he's granted an exemption because people are like, I don't want to have to pay, go bankrupt to heat my home in winter. So you can have these policy trajectories, but reality has a terrible way of intervening and derailing these transition policies.
And it's just one more example of why we have the very worst class of people in our societies making all of these decisions for us. Politicians are always going to be motivated by politics, period.
Yeah, not business. David, in the past, some companies merged. Repsol with IPF from Argentina. I'm not sure the name is correct. And others, but normally these state companies owned by the state are more difficult to receive these investments from foreign countries. So the expectation for the future for more mergers and acquisitions, you see that can happen, or the probability is low?
Well, I think in the United States, without any question, the probability is very high. Over the last quarter of this year, we're going to see more pretty sizable deals, probably not the magnitude of the Exxon Pioneer or Chevron Hess deal, But, you know, Chesapeake's looking for opportunities to acquire more assets in the Haynesville and Marcellus regions. ConocoPhillips, I expect Oxy is probably looking as well for an acquisition to remain competitive with Exxon and Chevron in the Permian Basin. Again, Shell and BP's a possible merger there. And these are all upstream, of course. Yeah, but you also have those opportunities. You know, there's thousands of upstream companies in the United States. And then you also have the midstream, where you have dozens of possible mergers between big pipeline companies and medium-sized pipeline companies. And even in the refining business, you could, as part of one of these deals or more, see mergers, a consolidation in the refining, the downstream part of the business. I just think that in talking with Andrew Dittmar over at Enverus and others, you know, we're going to have a very active next 3 to 12 months in the United States where mergers are concerned. It's harder to do outside of the United States, because as much as we complain about the Biden policies, the regulatory restrictions are still probably looser here in the U.S. for those types of deals than they are in Europe and other parts of the world. So I just think the U.S. shale sector has a lot of consolidation to come. And one of the drivers of that, I should add, probably the biggest driver of that, is economies of scale are so important in the shale sector. Because the more economies of scale you can derive, it drives down your break-even costs for these drilling projects in the shale sector of the business in particular. And so companies have for years been striving to get bigger and bigger in those big shale plays, and that's going to continue.
If I could comment, in Canada, Tourmaline Oil, where they're the largest natural gas producer, I think, in Canada, they made an acquisition about a week ago where they bought, if I can remember the name, Bonavista, which owns assets of proved and probable reserves of 459 million barrels of oil equivalent and a whole lot of natural gas. And they bought Bonavista for a cash and stock deal worth $1.45 billion Canadian, I think. So, you know, there's this companies that aren't considered majors, as you say, David, are actually also becoming larger and making these acquisitions to consolidate positions and increase asset base.
That's a very good point, Tammy. How can we consider a company like a major or a big oil? What's the point that David and Tammy?
Well, the majors are the companies that are fully integrated. They have upstream, midstream, and downstream assets. They control the whole value chain for their production. And that's why ExxonMobil, we talked about. Independent of the size. If you're fully integrated, you're considered one of the majors. Yeah. But, I mean, they're all big. All those companies are very big. Yeah. Devon Energy is, when you think about the independent producers who are looking to grow
upstream only,
pretty aggressively. There's rumors about Devon Energy, EOG Resources, and Diamondback Energy. ConocoPhillips is our biggest independent producer since they, you know, they separated their refining company into a separate company. But Diamondback Energy has been doing a lot of small bolt-on acquisitions of companies that have acreage that is you know, next door to their own acreage, and creating those kinds of efficiencies that way. And we can expect Diamondback, I think, to continue to that strategy, which has been very successful for them.
Tammy, what could be the factors, the motivation to these mergers? I mean, bad situation, financial situations, maybe one side, so you can buy someone that's not in a good position. But what are the factors that can motivate these mergers?
Well, I think it goes back to sort of what I said at the beginning, that, you know, if you have a declining asset base and you want to ensure that you've got enough product to go through your pipelines, especially for, as David described, the majors being these fully integrated companies. They need the product that they control. They know they're going to be able to get into their pipelines and refineries and service stations. So it makes sense if, you know, with these regulatory changes and whatnot, in order to ensure that they have a secure supply. And what I find interesting is that these acquisitions, for the most part, are taking place within the United States. And there's been some speculation that it's to ensure that the United States has more secure supply instead of going outwards, maybe, and acquiring companies that are abroad. But then again, maybe there's not so many. If it's a state oil company, you know, or a state major, you're not going to be able necessarily to buy shares in that. One of the interesting developments this past week, which is a little bit unrelated to the acquisitions that have been taking place, is the Biden administration removing sanctions and whatnot from Venezuelan oil. So yeah, they could have had the heavy oil or whatever coming from Canada, but the first thing he did was cancel Keystone. And now they have to import from Venezuela because, you know, the refiners maybe in Texas need that type of oil, which they can't necessarily get enough from Canada anymore. And it blows the mind that they go along and do those kinds of things.
And David, Chevron and Exxon are in Venezuela, I suppose. And so this is a kind of potential merger with PDVSA. Never.
Well, probably, yeah. Not while Maduro is running that country. That, you know, PDVSA is never going to be allowed to do that. When I was at Shell 17 years ago, Shell had operations, a very cooperative relationship with PDVSA, and was involved in several joint projects down there with that company. And it's such a shame. At that time, Venezuela was one of the most prosperous countries in the Western Hemisphere, even after all those years of Hugo Chavez. But since then, you know, of course, it's been this downward economic spiral as the government has become increasingly socialistic and authoritarian. And, you know, sadly, that's, I mean, they nationalized Shell's assets in that country, a decade ago now, and for other countries. ConocoPhillips has managed to continue its operations down there, and it will be the main beneficiary in terms of a U.S. company from Biden lifting those sanctions. Whether PDVSA is going to be able to really expand its own operations and exports as a result of that is pretty questionable, because that company has lost so much of its internal brain power and employee base over the years that it's going to be very difficult and time consuming for them to ramp up again. And it's just the saddest. Every time I think about Venezuela, it just makes me really sad, because it's such a tragic tale of how authoritarian governments can destroy prosperous countries, and have over the decades. You know, we see it time and time again, and we never seem to learn the lessons from it.
Well, if I could add something there, I think one of the biggest beneficiaries of the Venezuelan reopening or dropping of the sanctions is China, because Venezuela owes them a whole bunch of money. Yeah. And the Chinese National Oil Company is in partnership in the production there, because they needed skilled labor. China brings in the skilled labor. And then that increases the amount of oil on the market, which hopefully would reduce the price and so on. But it's amazing to me how these Western leaders in the United States and Europe are very happy to bring dictator oil to the world market, and because to keep the price lower or whatever, and then frustrate the development of, you know, freedom oil, or oil that's produced in democratically and environmentally responsible countries like Canada or the United States. And it's just...
Tell me, and the companies from Europe, I mean, Total Energy, Repsol, I don't remember other names, but they are potential let's see, buyers of other oil companies, you see these are opportunities?
Good question. That's a good question. I don't know. It's so
unpredictable.
I think it's unpredictable because of what the European policies are with their new sustainability standards. I think it's difficult for these companies to grow in their traditional form of operations, and yeah, which is, you know, as we discussed earlier, they end up having to invest a lot in renewables and buy offsets and all of these different things, because otherwise they're penalized, or, you know, they won't get the financing, or the governments turn the screws on them, the environmentalists take them to court, you know, the whole deal.
Yeah. People, let's go to the last part of our meeting today, innovating a little bit. So bringing each one the activities, the latest posts, what's coming, your websites. Let's start with this, David, please. You.
Well, I've been writing an awful lot about the EV industry and the problems it's having right now, as well as the wind industry. I'm working on a piece that is going to kind of combine those two topics and discuss the fact that solar seems to be the one leg of the three-legged energy transition stool that seems to be standing pretty strong at the moment. And when you really look at that, you have to wonder what happens to these other segments of that energy transition stool when the government subsidies run out, as they inevitably will. The spectacle of these big wind companies whose entire business model relies on government subsidies, now looking to governments in Germany and the United States for bailouts for their projects is pretty extraordinary. And, you know, we're all aware, I think, of how the Ford and GM electric vehicles business segments are really having a very difficult time and losing billions of dollars. So this year has not been kind to the energy transition, and I'm not sure 2024 is going to get any better for it. Oh, Peter. Hi, Peter. Isn't large-scale CCUS very expensive and still a large-scale experiment? I know we've been doing it for stimulation for years, but not just get rid of the carbon. I know you're talking about M&A, so perhaps a topic for another day. There's a diversity of opinions on that. ExxonMobil will tell you that they have no problem sequestering that carbon permanently. But of course, opponents of the oil and gas industry oppose CCUS and demonize the process because they know that CCUS helps to prolong the life of oil and gas as an industry. So, you know, there's a lot of competing narratives about that question, but you're right. We can probably dedicate a whole future episode to that.
That's a good idea. I know that they've been testing how long-term storage can work in certain geological formations. And the big global test case was in Saskatchewan, where they looked at the different types of formations that would be suitable and whatnot, and have been monitoring it for like 10 years or something to ensure that it doesn't move and all this kinds of stuff. And so I think that test, you know, has been completed, but it's these sort of large scale operations, like the one that they're doing in the UK, that will prove whether or not this is something that's worth doing. Yeah. And again, if it's really about getting rid of emissions, then, you know, that should be something that we pursue if that's what it is, and allows you to keep using oil and gas.
Yeah, it is so interesting to me that there's all this opposition to traditional CCUS, right, where you're taking the emissions from tailgates of manufacturing facilities, you know, and putting it in the ground. But you don't hear the same opposition narratives when companies like Oxy and other companies talk about just taking carbon out of the atmosphere, just willy-nilly taking it out of the atmosphere. Then that's part of CCUS supposedly is good, whereas the traditional CCUS is bad. Well, why is that? I mean, I think we all know what the answer is. They're also worried about trapping lithium in the formation. I'm not familiar with that. I'll have to do some research.
Yeah, I'd have to look at that further.
Spare refining capacity in Gulf Coast refineries for Venezuelan heavy crudes. Thank you. Hi, Victor. Yeah, that's a great question. There is spare capacity for heavy oil. There's not spare capacity for the light sweet crude that we're producing out of U.S. shale plays, which is why the U.S. has become one of the bigger exporters of oil in recent years. But yeah, there's plenty of spare capacity for the heavy crudes. At least for now.
Oh, Armando, you're...
Yeah, sorry. Tell me your activities and your predictions for your new work.
Okay, so on my podcast, the Nemeth Report podcast, I've got some new ones up. Last week, I talked with Terry Edom. He's a Canadian writer and works in the patch and he's just a great guy, understands a lot of what's happening in North America and whatnot. We had an excellent conversation, so please check that out. I'm going to be interviewing some more people over the next few weeks. I don't want to give anything away, but they should be pretty good. And I'm just working on various pieces regarding, for example, pension investments, what CCUS is doing in Canada, how that can move forward, what's the technology and whatnot. So a future episode on it will tie into to what I'm doing as well.
Great. In my case, we are returning our podcast because we was off 1 week. Following David, OTC Brazil, because every October we have OTC Brazil, the same OTC that we have every May in Houston. Making more videos, focusing on Brazil's issues as a very challenging phase in Brazil. And of course, last but not least, reading David's absurdities every day.
Of course. Yeah, love it.
It's the highlight of my day every day.
Thank you so much, people. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great week.
You bye. Too. Bye-bye. Bye.